Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight as Andrew Neil makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Now, he's well known to all of you, so I'll introduce him very briefly. Mr. Neil's a broadcaster with the BBC, and he's the publisher of The Spectator, and he has a distinguished career in British journalism and commentary, also as an author. And tonight he's going to talk for us on the geopolitics of America's pivot to the Pacific. So it'll be about a 30-minute talk. We'll take questions as usual, broadly on the topic, but on some other areas that Mr. Neil is interested in. And I should say we're delighted to do this tonight in cooperation with The Spectator Australia. This is a copy of the current issue, and there's some copies around. And I urge you all to be a subscriber, as Anne and I are. It's a great magazine, and we're very happy to do it with Tom Switzer, who's the editor of The Spectator Australia, which is part of The Spectator. So Andrew Neil is publisher of The Spectator, is going to speak for us tonight. Andrew Neil, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks to the Institute for inviting me here tonight. It's a privilege to be here, though for those of you who follow the BBC closely back in Britain, you will realise that I am one of the few available BBC presenters not currently under investigation by the police, which is why I'm able to be in Australia tonight. I'm slightly apprehensive because the last time I spoke in Sydney, which I think was about 5 years ago, at the end of my speech, a woman came up to me and said, "Mr. Neil, your speech was absolutely superfluous." And I said, "Thank you very much." And she said, "Tell me, is it going to be published?" And I, being a smart-ass journalist, said, "Yes, but probably posthumously." To which she replied, "I can hardly wait." So I hope to do it just a little bit better tonight. I'm going to, tonight, stand back from the day-to-day politics, particularly from where I come from, because they get more and more bizarre. In Europe, they get more bizarre than even fiction. Mr. Berlusconi, former Prime Minister of Italy, is now doing community service in an old folks' home in Milan, which I agree will be bizarre. So it will be no more bunga bunga for him, but probably lots of bingo bingo, as they have in old folks' homes. Our own British Prime Minister has just been stung by a jellyfish, Mr. Cameron, the blobby character without a spine has recovered fine, but I yet have had to get a medical report on the jellyfish. I want to speak tonight about the geopolitics of America's pivot to the Pacific. And in doing so, I don't have the impudence to come here and tell you what it means for the Pacific region, that is your region. What I'm going to talk about tonight is what it means for the Middle East and for Europe, to regions closer to my particular home. Let me begin this way. Last year, the United States surpassed Russia as the world's leading energy producer. This year, it will overtake Saudi Arabia as the world's largest producer of crude oil. When Mr. Obama entered the White House in 2009, in January, the U.S. imported 11 million barrels of oil a day, much of it from the Middle East. By the time Mr. Obama leaves the White House in 2016, the United States will import 0% of its oil from the Middle East. 0%. By 2020, the U.S. will be effectively energy independent. Early in the next decade, the United States, Canada, and Mexico combined will produce more hydrocarbons than the whole of the Middle East combined. Whole of the Middle East. Now, this has come about in the States because of the fracking revolution, which is producing vast quantities of natural gas and now tight oil. It is turning the United States into a major exporter of energy, first of LNG, liquid natural gas, but soon of oil too. It is going to Asia and to Europe. Aerospace used to be America's biggest export. It is now energy. Last year, energy accounted for $133 billion of American exports. And in the process, it has revolutionized American industry. And that is because U.S. gas prices are now a third of what they are in Europe and a fifth to a sixth of what they are in Japan. So industries that America once thought it had lost forever, chemicals, plastics, iron, aluminium, steel, rubber, metals, glass, are now all returning to production in America in rude health. In the States, they call it the homecoming. Dow Chemical, biggest petrochemical company in the world, is closing its operations in the European Union, in the United Kingdom, and in Japan, but is investing $30 billion in new ethylene production in Texas to take advantage of the cheap energy. I was filming a couple of years ago in the East Ohio Valley. It used to be the crucible of the steel industry in the United States. It has seen no investment for 50 years until 3 years ago when a £3 billion new steel plant was built to build pipelines, built by a French company, which hasn't invested in steel in France for 30 years. This is the homecoming. The combination of cheap energy, of cheap and productive labour, and of the US genius for technological innovation means it is always a mistake, even in the 21st century, to write off the United States. Now, my purpose tonight is not to talk about this new American Industrial Revolution, though it does contribute to a new sense of confidence and of 21st century possibilities in the United States. What I want to talk about tonight are two profound geopolitical consequences that are following from this energy revolution. The first is the perceptible disengagement of the United States from the Middle East and from Europe. From the Middle East, because if you don't need the oil and gas, then the region just doesn't matter so much in harsh realpolitik. And in Europe, because it is no longer the fulcrum of the Cold War or of geopolitical events and has very little to offer the United States as it pivots to the Pacific. And that is the second profound consequence that is now underway. It is the reinforcement of a geopolitical shift that would have happened anyway, but is giving it extra impetus, the pivot of the United States to the Pacific. Now, this would have happened whoever was in power. It is part of the shifts that are taking place on our planet. But it has happened more quickly under Mr. Obama. He was born in Hawaii. He went to school in Indonesia. He is the first ever president of the United States to have no blood or no historic ties with Europe. And by the way, Mr. Trump, he was born in Hawaii, which is part of the United States. He is the living definition of a Pacific president. But it would have happened anyway, and will continue to happen even when Mr. Obama departs the White House. Hillary Clinton, in her valedictory essay in Foreign Affairs magazine, when she stepped down as Secretary of State, said the future of the 21st century will be decided in East Asia, and the United States will be at the center of the action. These are the words of the ex-Secretary of State, and probably as we stand here at the moment, the person most likely to be the next President of the United States. And so the US moves to a position to position itself for what it thinks will be the central geopolitical struggle of the 21st century between a rising China and an America that is used to dominating the Pacific. Indeed, for a long while after the Second World War, regarded the Pacific, in effect, as its own private lake. And indeed, the dominance of the US Navy, post the demise of Japan in 1945, allowed Asia to prosper and grow through a period of overall regional peace. Not unlike the way the United States was able to prosper in the 19th century under the protection of the Royal Navy, which controlled the Atlantic. And East Asia has been able to grow because the US Navy provided that peace and the free sea lanes and certain rule-based laws that allowed commerce in East Asia to prosper as well. Now, proof of this pivot, I know, is sometimes contested, even in this part of the world, but it seems to me to be pretty much underway. The United States has already begun a historic shift in naval deployment. For every year since the end of the Second World War, the US Navy, bigger than about the next 10 navies combined, has been deployed 50% in the Pacific, 50% in the Atlantic. It has now begun, starting last year, a deployment in which by 2020 it will be 60% in the Pacific and 40% in the Atlantic. My own view is that it will go further than that. US Marines now train with the Australian Navy just outside Darwin. There is talk of a new US naval base for nuclear submarines in Western Australia. That, of course, is for you to decide. Pentagon budget cuts announced only a few months ago still allow for naval enhancements in the Pacific to counter the growing power of Chinese Navy. And of course, it is the Navy that the Chinese are investing in more than anything else, because they wish to push the Americans back from the near China Seas and the South China Sea, and they've got developing a powerful navy to do that. But the United States is continuing to invest to counter that. Six new PA-8s, the most sophisticated warships in the world, were recently deployed by the Pentagon to the region. There are war games going on spanning 22 countries, hundreds of US military exercises now in this region every year. And of course, with the United States' presence comes economic power and the attempt to get a free trade agreement, now encompassing not just Australia, which has been part of the negotiations, but every major European country, Asian country bar China, now including Japan, which, if Congress allows it, will encompass 40% of world trade and 40% of global GDP. That is the pivot to the Pacific, and I believe it will gather momentum. What are the consequences of this for the other key parts of the world? Let me begin with the disengagement from the Middle East, because this has the most serious consequences of all. Let me take you back to July and August of 2013, the dog days of a Washington, D.C. summer, when most people have already gone to Martha's Vineyard. In these 2 months, every Saturday morning, a group of senior aides to Mr. Obama met in the White House under the auspices of Susan Rice, the president's then new national security advisor. Their task was to plot a new U.S. future for the Middle East and to set the U.S. on a new course. And their deliberations, which were done in secret and got no publicity, were then largely unveiled by the president in his speech to the United Nations that September. And what he said was, these are now his Middle East priorities. First of all, to try and do some kind of nuclear deal with Iran. Secondly, to continue to try and get some sort of peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. And thirdly, to mitigate and contain the strife in Syria. Now, none of this is very surprising, except perhaps the effort to try and get a nuclear deal with Iran. But everywhere else, the United States in the Middle East would take a back seat. In Egypt, in particular, in the Arab Spring in general. Nothing said about the spread of democracy. Indeed, it was specifically not designated as a core interest. The unstated overall aim, which had come out of Ms. Rice's deliberations, was to avoid having the Middle East ever again swallow up the United States' foreign policy agenda or its military budget, as presidents before it had done. It scaled back not just George Bush II's freedom agenda, which by that time had become pretty discredited, but even the more expansive Obama agenda, which he had outlined in his speech in Cairo not long after he became president. It raised doubts that the United States would ever again use force in the region. Indeed, it raised doubts that the United States would ever again be involved in any military deployment. Why, after the pain of Afghanistan and of Iraq, if you don't need what that region has, why would you risk the lives, the men, the women, the materiel of the United States in that region again? And it was a push-me, pull-me phenomenon. Push away from the Middle East because it no longer matters so much to the United States. Pull to the Pacific because that is where the United States sees its main interests, its main opportunities, and its main threats in the 21st century. Now, nothing happens like that. This is a process. Legacy issues will continue to draw the United States back into the Middle East, much as it tries to escape. The pivot to the Pacific will not be seamless. It will be done badly in some ways. It will suffer setbacks. It will be quicker in some years and slower in others. But all processes have a direction, and this is the direction that the United States has now embarked on. Now, what are the consequences for the Middle East of this American withdrawal? Well, we've seen many of them already. In Libya, when Benghazi was under threat from the forces of Colonel Gaddafi, indeed, we faced a mass slaughter, it was the French and the British that had to do the heavy lifting. The Americans tried not to get involved. In Mali, the French had to go it alone. Indeed, at one stage, because the French lack a heavy lift capability, the Americans provided some of that heavy lift capability, and the Pentagon was going to charge the French for the fuel that it was using until the White House intervened. In Egypt, where the United States was once the external dominant influence, it is now regarded in Cairo as a growing irrelevance. Indeed, the Russians are now seen once again as at least as important, if not more important, than the Americans. In Syria, the president drew a line in the sand and then wished that he hadn't, and used the excuse of the British Parliament, which had voted down Mr. Cameron's efforts to get involved, to think. And it was interesting because I spent I was doing the live coverage of the vote in Parliament in London and then flew to the United States to see Mr. Obama replicate exactly what had happened in Britain, to get out of drawing a line in the sand that he wished he had never done. And so he got out of it. And how he got out of it was to say that there would not be any military intervention provided Mr. Assad did not use any more chemical weapons. Which, as a result, the de facto American position is that as long as you don't use chemical weapons, President Assad, you can basically do what you want to your people, and we won't intervene. And that is exactly what is happening as I speak in Syria tonight, where huge parts of that country, women are boiling grass for their children, and people are dying in their scores. There are 3 million refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, and in the southern borders of Turkey. In the Gulf monarchies, once the most trusted of allies of the United States, and a part of the Middle East that I particularly spend quite a lot of time there, the United States has gone from being the most reliable ally, the security provider for their security, is now seen as weak, dithering, and unreliable. And these are the politer words I feel I should use tonight. They are now proceeding, both the UAE and Saudi Arabia and the other countries there, on the basis that they can no longer count on the United States. And they believe, and this is their single biggest concern of all, that the United States has no interest in containing Iran in the Middle East. And if you go to the Gulf states, you will quickly realize that the fear of an expansionary Iran is the single biggest threat that they perceive, that they currently face. They had always thought they could depend on America. They believe that they will now have to go alone. Just as Mr. Obama agreed to a de facto deal in Syria, leaving Assad untouched, they believe that he will now do a deal on nuclear with Iran, which will leave Iran's super-regional power status untouched. the Middle East without America. What does that mean? Well, in the early 17th century, Europe was convulsed by what came to be known as a 30 Years' War. It was a 30 Years' War in which Catholics and Protestants basically killed each other at every opportunity they could get. They did so until they came to their senses with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. The Middle East, in my view, is now gripped in its version of the 30 Years' War. But instead of Catholics and Protestants, it is Sunni and Shia. And this Sunni and Shia battle is overlaid by a constant battle between secular Islam and Islamists on the other side. And that is especially true in what we used to call the Maghreb and is now known generally as North Africa. The Sunni-Shia divide is now what divides the Lebanon, with a little bit of Christian grit thrown into the mill. The Sunni-Shia divide is the fundamental cause of the civil war in Syria. The Assads are part of the Alawite clan. The Alawites are a sect of the Shia. Most of the insurgents against the government are Sunni. In the Gulf states, which are, with the exception of Bahrain, large Sunni majorities, they are terrified by Iran's bid for leadership for political Islam, because, of course, Iran is a Shia state. And in all these areas now, you can see proxy wars being fought out by Sunni and Shia interests. In Syria, Hezbollah playing a major military force against the insurgents on behalf of the Assad regime. Hezbollah, of course, being a Shia sect. Iran backing the Alawite clan as their ideological religious soulmates. The Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris are Sunni nations fighting proxy wars by backing the rebels in these areas. And as I say, the fact that the United States is no longer part of any of this means that the Saudis now believe that they're on their own. And the only country, and of course in Iraq as well, which so much blood and treasure was spent, there you have now seen the emergence of a Sunni Shia war, with a Shia government, majority Shia government in Baghdad, but the west of Iraq increasingly under the control of Sunni insurgents, often controlled by Al-Qaeda, which of course is a Sunni terrorist movement. So the Saudis are now moving into a position where they think they have to act for their own, and they are getting into a position where Iran gets the bomb. And so the Saudis will do what they always do when they're in trouble. They will attempt to buy their way out of trouble. And they are currently moving into a position where they could produce a nuclear weapon themselves within months. This is not widely known, but I can assure you it's known by both British and American intelligence. It has the money to do so, and it has close and dangerous allies in Pakistan, which has the technology, nuclear, has the missile delivery systems, and of course needs the money. It is inconceivable. You do not understand anything about the Gulf region or the Middle East if you think the Shias can have the bomb and the Sunnis cannot. The moment it is clear that the Shias in the form of Iran have the bomb, then the Saudis will get their own quickly as well. And the Pakistanis are a Sunni nation, and they will get it from Pakistan. Indeed, I think there's a lot of evidence that the Saudis have helped to bankroll the Pakistan nuclear program precisely for this eventuality. And they will do it quickly, and they've already been testing the missiles that would allow the bomb to be delivered. So that is the prospect of the Middle East with the America gone. No one else powerful enough to hold the ring or to knock heads together. And so the Middle East, which despite American energy independence will still be a major source of energy for the rest of the world, particularly the emerging markets in Asia, particularly India and China, the Middle East will become like South Asia, like the subcontinent, yet another part of the world dominated by a nuclear standoff. That is the geopolitical danger that is faced by trends that are now underway. What are the consequences for Europe? Well, America may be energy independent, but Europe is still dependent on Russian gas and Middle East oil, as we have seen during the Ukraine crisis, which is why it's been very hard to get the Europeans to take much of a sanction against the Kremlin. Yet they are still dependent on US military power, which they know in their heart of hearts cannot last. In 2001, the United States accounted for 63% of NATO defense expenditure. And yet as Europe became less and less important to the United States, as the Cold War went back into history, US share of NATO expenditure rose. It rose to 75% as the European Union countries ran down their own military spending in the wake of the financial crisis that hit the Eurozone and other parts of Europe. And because of that financial crisis, the continued need to finance welfare spending. Yet Europe is no longer crucial to US geopolitical strategy. And at a time when the Pentagon budget itself is being squeezed, and there are new interests and threats to deal with in the Pacific region, it seems to me inconceivable that the United States will continue to finance 75% of NATO expenditure. There is despair in Washington over what Europe will do when that happens. In Washington, D.C., they now speak privately of, quote, the collective military irrelevance of Europe. And yet it is Europe that will have to fend for itself as the United States pivots to the Pacific. And it is hard to think of a worse time for Europe to have to face up to the challenges that it has. Indeed, when I think of Europe, it reminds me of an interview I once did with Mr. Yeltsin when he was president of the Russian Federation. And I said to Mr. Yeltsin, could you sum up in a word the state of the Russian economy? And he looked at me and he said, good, good. And I said, excuse me, Mr. President, it's an English expression. You can use more than one word. And he looked at me again and he said, not good, not good. Which brings me to Europe. There is no public appetite in Europe, on the left or on most of the mainstream right, for an increase in defense spending. And that's understandable, because the continent is overwhelmed by economic problems. The unemployment rate in Spain is 20%. In Greece, it's 24%. In France, it's 12%. In Italy, it's 14%. The unemployment rate among young people, classified as between 16 and 28, is 58% in Spain, 60% in Greece, 25% in Italy and in France. If you happen to be young French and Algerian, it's 60%. These are huge unemployment problems. You know, you've got an unemployment rate of what? Just under 6% at the moment? Kind of places things in context. There has been no growth for some time. Indeed, the European Union or the Eurozone has swapped a financial crisis for economic stagnation. And it is now on the brink of a deflationary trap. Prices throughout the Club Mediterranean countries, as we call them, somewhat disparagingly, by that I mean Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, Cyprus, prices there are beginning to fall. You will know better than I the condition of Japan over 20 years when it actually fell into the deflationary trap and found it almost impossible to escape from it. Huge parts of Europe are now on the edge of a deflationary trap. Prices are now falling in a number of European countries, and it's not confined just to the south. In Sweden, one of the most successful European economies, not even part of the Eurozone, prices fell 0.4% in March. Now, the problem with the deflationary trap, something that we in Europe have no experience of, our whole lives have been spent fighting inflation, as I'm sure Australia has also had experience of, is that if you think prices tomorrow are falling, you do not go and buy that car. You do not go and buy that TV set, because you know it's going to be cheaper tomorrow, and when tomorrow comes, you're told it'll be cheaper the next day. And that is the deflationary trap that huge parts of Europe are now on the brink of. Now, you add to that the collapse of political leadership in Europe. And by that I mean the end of the Franco-German alliance as being the motor that ran Europe. Ever since the Treaty of Rome in 1957, the Germans and the French between them called the shots. They would meet before every European summit. They would decide what was to happen, and that's what would happen at the summit. The problem is that Berlin and Paris have now gone their own separate ways. The whole Franco-German alliance involved some kind of conceit. It involved the French thinking they were as powerful as the Germans, and it involved the Germans encouraging everybody to think the French were as powerful as the Germans, because the Germans are terrified of being thought to be too powerful. That conceit can no longer hold. The German economy is growing and is hugely successful. The French economy is struggling to stay with the northern economies, but risks slipping into the Club Med economies. And we saw in Libya, where the French and the Germans parted company, in Syria, where they parted company, and in the Ukraine, where they have parted company as well, we have seen that that no longer works. So the political mechanism, the political will to do something about the challenges Europe faces is no longer there. And it is likely that United States policy in the years ahead, as it pivots to the Pacific, is going to feel more kindly to protect its friends in Asia, who are prepared to spend money on their defence, than the Europeans, who are not only prepared not to spend money on their own defence, but actually bring nothing to the table, either diplomatically or militarily, in the pivot to the Pacific. US policy, I think, will now protect its friends in Asia, and not what those, particularly in the Republican part of the United States, sneer as their free-riding Europeans. US Asian allies are willing to invest in their own defence. Indeed, Asian military budgets have now overtaken Europe. It's quite remarkable. Since 2008, Asian defence, this excludes China, is $173 billion a year. European combined defence, $144 billion. So there is a systemic problem there. And future US leaders post the Cold War are likely to consider, in my view, US investment in NATO not worth the cost that it's been. And even when we Europeans do spend money on defence, we rarely spend it wisely. Remember, overall now in the EU, defence spending is 1% of GDP. The Americans are still spending almost 5% of their GDP. You are 1.5%, I believe, Mr. Abbott has said he's going to take you to 2%. Only Greece and Britain spend 2% of their GDP on defence. British for partly historic reasons, the Greeks because they're terrified of Turkey, which is much more powerful than them. But even when we spend it unwisely. We have no heavy lift capability worth speaking of. The Europeans have no capability of projecting force to areas that would be required to keep the sea lanes open, or to keep the oil flowing, or to keep their energy coming in. Indeed, when we spend it, it is often spent badly. In Belgium, not a great military power, but part of the NATO alliance, 70% of Belgian defence goes on pay and pensions. 70%. So as one Belgian politician said to me, it is really a mistake to think that we in Belgium have any military at all. We just have an unusually well-armed pension fund. And even in Britain, which does spend still, despite the cuts, almost 2% of its defence. Let me give you this example to show how it doesn't lead to the ability that you may think it need. We are currently building 2 giant aircraft carriers in Britain, bigger than any other aircraft carriers in the world, except for the JFK-class American aircraft carriers. They will be state-of-the-art aircraft carriers. They will be formidable. They are capable between them of carrying 72 fighters. They will carry the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, the most formidable fighter plane that's ever been built. It's a Lockheed British Aerospace development. It is probably the last ever manned fighter jet that the world will see. And our aircraft carriers, when they come online, are capable of carrying 72 of these state-of-the-art fighters. Now, this is a force to project and put fear in anybody who gets in your way. Except for one problem. Only one aircraft carrier will be available at any one time. one will permanently be in mothballs, and that one that is active will only have 12 Joint Strike Fighters to call on. So in other words, despite this massive investment, only a sixth of the capability of this investment will be deployed by the British at any one time. So you see the dilemma, the potentially catastrophic consequences for the Middle East. You see the difficulties Europe has of facing this geopolitical pivot of America to the Pacific, and how at the moment we are not in a position to be able to deal with the consequences in ways that we should. It was said of Trotsky that it was a measure of how far-seeing he was that none of his predictions had yet come true. If the Institute is kind enough to invite me back again in 5 years' time, I can assure you I will not need the Trotsky defense. What I'm talking about is already underway, has been without our politicians realizing it for some time, and in my view, can only gather momentum in the years ahead. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Andrew. I think Trotsky also is alleged to have said that worse is better, but not quite sure how that all fits in. I should say thanks to King and Wood Mellicent for the use of this facility this evening, and thanks to the Spectator for making Andrew Neil available to us. And as I said, Tom Switzer, the editor of the Spectator Australia, has left some copies around. You can pick them up after, and they've got subscription forms inside them. So we come to questions and discussion. If Andrew Neil, if you just come back here and stay where you were before, I'll come over here. Thanks for an important analysis. Just in view of what you said, which is a very substantial comment, how then do you depict John Kerry's apparent obsession with striking some kind of Middle East deal between Israel and the Palestinian Authority? Because he seemed to have spent many visits there without much outcome. But do you think this is the United States' final fling in the Middle East?
It is because John Kerry is probably the last man standing in D.C. that still thinks Europe matters. And it's very interesting that, he was brought up as a lad in Berlin. He knows Europe. He speaks French. He is part of that State Department tradition that regards Europe as the centerpiece of American foreign policy. But it's not what they think in the White House. It's not even what a majority in the State Department thinks. And the view in the White House was, there's no American president can say, I'm not going to bother doing a peace deal. I'm not going to bother trying to do a peace deal with the Israelis and the Palestinians. And Mr. Kerry was willing, and the view was to let him get on with it. He'll almost certainly fail, but let him get on with it. And it is not, part of the problem, the White House realizes it, but most Western opinion doesn't. Israel-Palestine isn't even the most important problem in the Middle East, never mind in the rest of the world. And it's a legacy issue that the Americans still feel they have to be involved in, but they know in their heart of hearts will not be resolved. Even Hillary Clinton, a much stronger Secretary of State than John Kerry, was unable to permeate the cadre of foreign policy aides around the president in the White House. And they have not been involved in this. This has been a State Department play, and the failure plays only in the State Department. I go to the Gulf 6-7 times a year. I'm chairman of a company that publishes almost 70 magazines in the Gulf region. We're the biggest publisher of magazines in the Gulf. And I see the leaders of the Gulf regularly. Not one of them has ever raised Israel-Palestine. Not one of them with me. They have all raised, what will America do about Iran? Do you think we can count on them or not?
Okay, so there's a question here.
Thanks very much for an interesting address. I think the American view, the presidential view, is of Russia, the way it's behaving. Doesn't it matter?
Yes, it does. And as I said in my address, legacy issues will constantly bring the United States back to Europe and the Middle East as well. And as I also said, this is a process. This is we're no longer in the Middle East, we're now in the Pacific. It's a process that's taking place over time. And it's not America's not out of Europe. It still has very important bases, particularly in Germany and in the United Kingdom as well. And, of course, Ukraine matters. And, of course, the Americans are concerned about the actions of Mr. Putin. However, when it came to doing something about it, they couldn't get the Europeans to come on side. The European sanctions are much weaker than the American sanctions. Now, of course, the Americans have got much less to lose. 30% of Russian gas, 30% of German gas comes from Russia. Indeed, it has taken the events in the Ukraine for the Europeans to face up to the Department of the Bleeding Obvious. They are over-dependent on Russian energy. And they're now desperately trying to move to find ways to diversify their sources. And they can do that. So, of course, the Americans think this is important. But there was a very important briefing. I'd urge you to read the... because it was now published in the... It's the lead story in this morning's International... I was going to call it the Herald Tribune. It's now the International New York Times. And that is... It's where and this has not come from the State Department. It's come from the White House. And what it says is that we can't deal with Putin. We realize that there's no way, that we've given up. Because remember, Mr. Obama tried to recalibrate his relationship with Russia. They're now saying that's a failure. They will simply try to contain him with some sanctions. And they will need to make it clear that whereas there's very little they can do about the Ukraine or Crimea or even Belarusia or Kazakhstan, where there's a big Russian-speaking population too, that those countries that are members of NATO are not up for negotiation. And that includes the Baltic states. And indeed, as we speak tonight, US troops have been deployed for military exercises in Poland. But it is not. It is simply not a priority. I'll tell you what America's long-run revenge will be on the Kremlin. And it's by long run, I mean over the next 5 to 10 years. And that is, they will, as they're now in the process of doing, grant massive export licenses for the export of natural gas. There are 14 LNG ports all down the east coast of America, down into the east side, the west side of Florida. At the moment, only 3 of them, I think, have been granted export licenses. But very quickly, all licenses, and indeed if Europe does a free trade deal with America, it is automatic that they can export natural gas to Europe. Indeed, there's a plant in Grangemouth. It's a petrochemical plant in Grangemouth in Scotland, which has been kept alive now by the import of LNG from the United States. And the moment you flood the world market with America's surplus of LNG, at the moment there's very little is being exported, the world price of gas comes down. Just think, we've been through Ukraine, Syria, the problems in Egypt, and the problems in Libya, which is a huge gas and oil producer. And the price of oil and the price of gas has fallen because the United States has stopped importing and it's allowed the gas to go elsewhere. The Kremlin, the official figures say 50%. I believe it's over 60% of their revenues come from hydrocarbons. They need a price of $100 a barrel in oil to be able to pay for the various programs that keeps Mr. Putin in power. 70% of everything the Russians export is either oil or gas. If the American Revolution in energy results in a huge export of American oil and gas, there is real trouble down the road for Mr. Putin. When did you last buy anything from Russia? What does Russia make? What does Russia provide as a service? Right. Most of that comes from Sweden and Poland.
I agree with what you're saying about the Middle East and Israel, except Israel is a very important symbolic and emotional sort of pin for much of Western democratic countries, and it's got huge clout in its own way. America has supported Israel through many decades. So what's the future for Israel in all of this? Will Israel maybe be released from its sort of, notion that it's going to be destroyed in some way and be allowed some sort of freedom in the midst of all this self-destruction of the Arabs?
America will not give up its commitment to Israel, I believe. It is just written into the DNA of American politics. It used to be overwhelmingly on the Democrat side because the Jewish lobby was most powerful. Now the Republicans, particularly, have got religion. and the Christian right is very strong supporters of Israel too. So they've got it covered in both parties. I would simply say two things. One is that the United States was a huge, staunch supporter of Israel long before it took a gallon of oil from Saudi Arabia. And I think it continues when it stops taking any more oil from Saudi Arabia too. And secondly, although Israel is quite rightly worried about the countries that surround it, these countries at the moment are knocking lumps out of each other. They're no threat to Israel. I mean, Syria used to have a really powerful army. It's decimated now. Remember in 1973, when the Egyptians attacked in Yom Kippur, they almost won. There's no way the Egyptian army could do that today. It's among the walking wounded. Most of its weaponry doesn't work. So although it is obviously you're a small country, barely the size of Wales, population of about 8 million, which is more than Wales, and you see this chaos going on around, that's obviously a cause for concern. But if your enemies are fighting among yourselves, and if even they don't regard you as the most important problem in the Middle East, then I kind of think Israel, at least in the foreseeable future, will not find... it's a very good question, because you would think, logically, if the America is moving, as I'm arguing, out of the Middle East, that Israel would be a major victim, or at least be vulnerable to that. But for the two reasons I've given, one, that their enemies are fighting among themselves, and secondly, that America, I think, sticks by it anyway as a particular alliance. I would simply say one more thing. It's very interesting. That before the Arab Spring, the only thing you could demonstrate about in Cairo, or Tunis, or Tripoli, was Israel. Where you could say what you want. Now you can attack the government. Now you can complain about the price of bread. Now you can complain that your kid hasn't got a job. And we were recently involved in my company in a major survey of Arab opinion. Among young Arabs, Israel didn't come anywhere in that survey. They were worried that they couldn't get a job. They were worried that the price of food was soaring. They were worried that they wouldn't even enjoy the living standards their parents had enjoyed.
Thanks for the presentation, Andrew. We've spoken about Russia a lot. We haven't really spoken about the European Union as such. And you spoke about the great disparity between Germany growing with its economy and France with its huge population unemployed. What do you see of the future of the European Union? Because I was living in Europe when it was put together, and you know, you see the disparity amongst the different countries. What's the future, and how's that going to play out?
Well, actually, I did speak rather a lot about Europe, and my argument was that because of both economic reasons, in other words, the stagnation and the danger of a deflationary trap, and the lack of a political motor to run Europe anymore because of the de facto collapse of the Franco-German alliance, that Europe is not well placed to deal with the challenges I'm talking about. It is entirely, quite rightly, if all you young people are so many of you young people are unemployed, it is quite rightly concerned with its own economic problems. But that doesn't allow, therefore, to raise its head and face the geopolitical challenges that are currently, that I believe, currently confronted. So I think there's a lot of wealth in Europe, and Europe is overall a hugely successful region. The European Union is still by far the biggest market, coherent market in the world. There are still some incredible European companies there too. But I wouldn't say that either economically or politically Europe was well placed to face the geopolitical changes that are currently taking place. And even industrially, I talked about Dow Chemical with its withdrawal from Europe and Japan in terms of new investment and its massive investment in Texas. BASF, which is a petrochemical company almost as big as Dow Chemical and the Germany's biggest, huge German company, in with the web of German society, has told the German government that unless they do something about energy prices, they will have to follow in the wake of Dow Chemical and invest in the United States.
Right down the back.
Yes. Does your comment about Israel's relationship with the United States being in the DNA of United States politics still pertain if the demography of the United States changes in the next 50 years?
No, it probably doesn't, though I don't know. I mean, I recently had lunch with Mark Rubio, junior senator in Florida, potential Republican hopeful candidate in the 2016 Republican primaries. He's a huge supporter of Israel. I mean, I take the point of your question. I think it's just hard to tell.
The point of that is that he's of Latin American background.
That's my point, yes. And that's partly the question that you're talking about, the demography of it changes. All I would say is that the American demography isn't changing that quickly, and the political elite is behind the American demography, in that there aren't that many Mark Rubios around, that the Hispanics have yet still to work their way in a broad level to the where their numbers would justify them being part of the Washington decision-taking process. So, yes, in 20, 30, 40 years' time, I think that is a very legitimate concern if you were an Israeli. All I would say is that I'm just a journalist. I'm not Mystic Meg, and I can't see what's going to happen 20 or 30 years' time.
Now we're getting close to the end, so I've got to be very brief. There's one here, then down the back. Yes.
Good. So Australia is part of the Pacific. We have been having sort of micro debates here about China and the role we should play. I think Australia is perhaps exaggerating its the word role in this thing. What do you think? Do you think there are consequences for Australia of this pivot, other than Darwin and having a few American troops?
I've been here twice. This is my second visit. I got off the plane at 5 a.m. this morning. I do not have the impudence to tell you about Australia. I'm afraid that's something, with the consequences for Australia, that's a matter for you. And indeed, I hope when we have dinner later tonight with some of your colleagues, that you will tell me what I should be thinking about Australia. All I will say is something I do know, because I do know a lot about the United States, and that I wouldn't underestimate how important America thinks you are. The United States thinks Australia is very important. It regards that Darwin base, I know it's small, I know we're not meant to call it a base, that it's simply a training mechanism for US Marines, but they are now training with the Australian Navy. I also believe, although this isn't public, that they're training with Australian Special Forces.
Okay,
we're going to go. And you're a big exporter. Yeah, but America doesn't need that.
I can see a future US president channeling Al Pacino saying, every time I try to get out, they suck me back right back in. With regard to the Middle East, the thing about the Sunni Shia war is that it exports and there's blowback, as was evidenced by September 11, Boston, 2007 in London. How do you see the US response in the event of a next nuclearized attack?
Well, I don't think I said that we were going to be attacked by nuclear weapons. I may think the situation in the Middle East has potential for great danger, but I don't think the Saudis are actually going to attack New York with a nuclear bomb. Can I just point out that the attack on 9/11 happened before the Sunni-Shia 30-year war broke out? And indeed, you could look at this either way. You could look and say, if they're so busy knocking lumps out of each other, have they got time to come and bomb London and New York? Or, more dangerously, you could look at it that this Sunni-Shia civil war is sucking in young jihadists from the council houses of Bradford and Scunthorpe and from the banlieue of Paris and Lyon and Marseille and from the suburbs of Hamburg, and that they will be trained there and come back well-trained to do what they've been trained to do. And it is the single biggest concern of our intelligence agencies at the moment, which is that the terrorist attacks in the future will have Yorkshire accents. As 5777 had in London in the attack on the underground. So my only point would be that I think that the Western threat of terrorism to the West will be there whether the Sunni-Shia war existed or not. It did before, it will continue with. If one day the Arab world has its peace of Westphalia, that may be when that terrorist war recedes. Terrorist threat recedes. There is a national intelligence assessment in the United States, of which only parts have been published, that does think that there will be an Arab equivalent of a Peace of Westphalia at some stage towards the end of the next decade. So it's still almost a 30 years war. And that by the 2030s, that terrorist threat will largely have faded for the Western world. But who knows?
Just curious to listen. I was hearing things. Tony Abbott was talking about military exercises with the US and China. Is that anyone else hear that from his
perspective? You're asking me about your Prime Minister.
He was essentially talking about military exercises between Australia and China, and said at some stage in the future the US may or may not join in. So, Robert.
Some years ago, the retiring Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia, Anthony Mason, was asked what he read in his leisure time at the Sydney Institute, and he answered The Spectator, which is a remarkable endorsement from a most unlikely source. You've given us a terrific talk tonight. Why don't you write more often for The Spectator instead of us having to read the grammatical strictures of Dr. Wordsworth or The Social Diary of Joan Collins?
Well, at the Sydney Institute, there is a Joan Collins faction here, so you've got to be...
You have only, to me, underlined the diversity and eclectic nature of the Spectator, which not only did have a diary by Joan Collins, but also had a cover story with Mr. Obama on a surfboard called Obama's Pivot to the Pacific. So... You can make your choice. I am also, because of my BBC obligations, very limited in what I can write. But I thank you all for listening to me tonight. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
So many thanks to Andrew Neil. It was a very important speech tonight. I'm gratified by your modesty. Many a visitor who gets off the plane at 5 o'clock is an expert on Australia by dinner time. So I've been quite constrained, and we're very impressed. So congratulations on a fine speech tonight and taking all those questions. Thanks to Tom Switzer, the editor of The Spectator Australia, for making this possible. Thanks for coming along and for filling out this big audience on what's effectively a very slow day in Sydney. We're very grateful you're all here. We had a terrific night, and well done, Andrew. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.